All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this editions of Blood Club. I'm Matt Lunning from the University of Nebraska, and I'm joined today by my colleague Loretta Nastapil from MD Anderson Cancer Center. And what is the most important thing about Blood Club is that you talk about Blood Club. So it's not supposed to be a secret. You know, this is an informal discussion about where we're at in hematologic malignancies these days. And so I was thinking this time, Loretta, we would talk a little bit about follicular lymphoma. You know, it's one of our most common non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, but I still think that people talk about it because they don't always know what to do when they see the diagnosis. And I think even in the frontline setting, you know, a new diagnosed patient, sometimes the workup, the evaluation can be sometimes, you know, you think it's like large cell lymphoma, but is it always like large cell lymphoma? So how do you work up these patients when they present to your clinic?
Thanks, Matt. And thanks for inviting me to talk about one of my favorite topics. I think some of the challenges with follicular lymphoma is that it's so heterogeneous, both in terms of presentation, but also some of the pathologic features. So a typical situation I see regularly is a patient has imaging studies done for some reason. Either they have some surgery coming up or they had a mammogram, for instance, and there's axillary nodes that are picked up. No one's thinking they have lymphoma. Doctor tells them they have something abnormal in their scan that prompts a biopsy from a radiologist, and then you get back features that are suggestive of follicular lymphoma. So classically, it's a B-cell lymphoma, so it's going to express CD20. It's a germinal center-derived B-cell lymphoma, so it's going to be CD10 positive. Morphologically, it gets its name from the fact that you have overgrowth of the follicles. And if you happen to have a bone marrow biopsy, which we can talk about the controversies of that right now, you'll have paratrabecular infiltrate of lymphocytes. And they generally are small cleave cells. It used to be called a small cleave cell lymphoma. And so those are some of the features. The heterogeneity lies in terms of how hard it is to predict the future for patients. So some may have a very indolent case where they may not need treatment for many years or one or two treatments over a 20 to 30 year period. Whereas others, and a perfect example is a patient I met this week that he's in his late 50s. He's already progressed through multiple lines of therapy just in the last 2 years. It was even thought to be maybe large cell lymphoma because it was behaving so aggressively, but every time he has a biopsy, it's still follicular lymphoma. And now we're struggling to find a treatment that's going to change this. So those are very different scenarios, but still within the realm of possible with this disease.
So are you commonly utilizing PET scans in order to stage this disorder? I mean, one of the interesting things is I think that follicular lymphoma lives on a spectrum, right? You have pathologically, you know, under the microscope, you're looking at grade 1 and then grade 2 and then 3A, 3B, and then, you know, all the way to the right, you know, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And, you know, I really struggle when CAT scans are enough versus when to dip your toe into the PET scan waters, you know, to just make sure there's no, you know, inconspicuous lymph node. You know, I always call it the Sesame Street lymph node. Which one of these is not like the other? Follicular lymphoma and indolent lymphomas, I'm often looking for those.
Yeah, again, there's no right or wrong answer, but let me tell you what I do. For patients that are newly diagnosed, we generally do get a PET diagnosis to identify the things you just sort of pinpointed. About 10% of the time, patients can have both follicular and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma when they're first diagnosed. So I do use PET to help me make sure that I feel like we've biopsied the most worrisome lesion. Now, there's a ton of controversy, and I'm not going to pretend to know where you draw a line in the sand with SGB Max to feel confident that it's follicular or it's large cell. But as you mentioned, I do like the analogy of if I have an SUV that's 35, but I biopsied a lymph node with an SUV of 4, I'm not going to feel confident that both of those lymph nodes are encompassed by the same disease process. There are other times I get a PET, and that's usually at the end of treatment to document how deep is our response. And I do think we have more complete response rates in the PET era than we did in the CT era. Whether or not that translates into longer remission, Judith Trotman suggests with her work across a number of studies that might be true. It may be even a better overall survival if you have a PET CR at the end of induction. So that's why I tend to like to get it then. And then after that point, I usually only get a PET if I'm worried about transformation or if I need to put them on a treatment where having a PET at baseline would be helpful, such as a clinical trial or maybe CAR T, for instance. That's where the art of this comes in. And so I generally will follow patients either with exam and history or CTs. And then if I see something that's alarming to me, such as a rapid change in the size of a lymph node or those B symptoms patients are always annoyed we ask about that they rarely have, calcium or LDH being really high, that's when I may then just get a PET in those situations.
So in 2023, with all of the, you know, exciting new treatments that we have for follicular lymphoma, is it still appropriate to not treat an asymptomatic follicular lymphoma patient?
Yes. And the reason I think that's true is even though we're super excited about the new treatments, nothing comes without some cost. And so toxicity is going to, now it's going to vary dramatically depending on how aggressive you are with treatment. But I always tell patients there's no free lunch. So you do manage expectations. And sometimes the idea of having cancer and not having some sort of active therapy is more detrimental to them than the disease itself. So there are times when I absolutely will recommend what I view as some of the most gentlest treatment, which is something like rituximab monotherapy for someone who really doesn't have a lot of disease, but they're struggling with the idea of having cancer. I'm super excited about the newer therapies that are emerging, such as the bispecifics. But again, there's still toxicity that comes along with that. So I still reserve my therapy for those where I feel like the scale is tipped towards I need to do something about it and the side effects are justifiable.
Speaking of no free lunch, a lot of our, you know, upfront therapies here are either chemo immunotherapy, whether or not you're considering bendamustine rituximab, bendamustine obinutuzumab. I think that that's, you know, still a little bit controversial what the CD20 is. But then you start to throw into the mix things like lenalidomide and now lenalidomide-based combinations. And we're seeing some really exciting upfront clinical trials starting to emerge in follicular lymphoma. How are you kind of separating out who gets the classical chemo backbones and who you're kind of, if you can get them, the lenalidomide based, and then maybe speak to some of the exciting clinical trials that you're seeing come through the pipeline?
Ed, well, I have to acknowledge my bias. So I work in a center where I conduct clinical trials. So I'm going to choose a trial every time I get that opportunity. And I'll make my pitch for why I think we should do trials in follicular lymphoma, because you could make the argument that the outcomes are so good and we're probably approaching a functional cure for the majority of patients. Meaning I do tell them that depending on when they have events, they should anticipate a normal life expectancy, particularly if they go a while before they have anything bad happen to them in terms of progression, et cetera. But that being said, I think the challenge for this disease is the unpredictability. And so when you meet with a patient and you tell them, yes, I'm sorry, you have cancer and this is something that has to be managed, but I don't know when it's going to be a problem. I don't know if you're in the 80% camp where you should anticipate a normal life expectancy, or you're in that 20% camp where things are not going to be good for you in terms of, again, I illustrated the case of rapid progression through very effective therapies that I should have thought all of them would have worked. And so why doesn't it? And so I think that sets the stage for we need to do more research so we have a better understanding of what makes the disease so heterogeneous. Is there a preferred route? Are there patient characteristics or disease characteristics that will help us navigate among this ever-expanding treatment landscape? The patients I really want to put on trial are those that it's looking like large cell lymphoma, but I get a biopsy and it comes back follicular, meaning they've got a ton of disease, they have all the symptoms, the LDH is high, and I'm shocked when I look at the path and they're calling it a low-grade follicular lymphoma. To me, there's something seriously different about that situation. But even for my low tumor burden patients, I have no issues. So for instance, we just conducted a trial where we gave half the patients vitamin D and half got placebo. All low tumor burden. Now, they all got 4 weekly doses of rituximab, so it wasn't a no treatment versus something. But that was a really easy study to conduct in a low-risk patient population where we're really testing, can vitamin D alter something? And so there's so many different flavors of studies that I think you should always look for trials. Where I hope we'll be in the next 5 years is that we kind of do move away from chemotherapy just because of all the emotional baggage that comes along with it.
So let's say you do choose to give R-squared lenalidomide rituximab as your induction strategy and the patient does relapse. What are you going to in the second line? And let's just get even a little more controversial because you alluded to the 20%. You know, I really think it's probably the 2%. Of these patients that truly meet this progression of the disease within 24 months. If you follow strictly the R-CHOP or the RCVP, and then you're actually catching them not in surveillance imaging, but truly because they're symptomatic and they say, I got something, you know, golf ball in my right neck here, that, and that comes back follicular lymphoma. What are you doing in second line after R squared? Because I don't think there's a lot of guidance, actually.
Now, this is actually the biggest challenge we have right now, not just in terms of what we call standard of care or, you know, real world practice, but also our trials, because our trials are set up for specific populations, anticipating that most patients will get an alkylator or chemotherapy based backbone as frontline. And so when you're looking at trial eligibility in second line for those patients who've never had chemo, that's a real conundrum. And then if you want to use a T-cell engager, how do you sequence that around bendamustine? So I actually don't give much lenalidomide frontline outside of a trial. Now, all of our trials, at least the ones that we are excited about, have a lenalidomide-based approach. So I do have about half my population that have had len on a trial. Those are patients when they relapse, we're going on to the next trial because they have the ability to participate on trial. They're already demonstrated they're interested in trial, but it has become challenging to identify studies they can qualify for because they haven't had chemo already.
Right.
For those patients, like you mentioned, that I do think are much higher risk, those that are actually progressing and symptomatic, either on therapy or shortly thereafter, particularly if it's chemotherapy-based, those to me are really high-risk patients. So I'm going to try really hard to get them on trial. But what happens if they don't qualify or they need to go home and receive their treatment? I like giving bendamustine frontline for my patients that I'm not worried about occult transformation or they're not on trial. With all the controversies that are surrounding infection and T-cell complications and risk for second cancers, but it's the easiest to give. And if you look at the supplemental data of relevance, which was R chemo versus R squared or lenalidomide rituximab, when you look at the chemo administered versus R squared, there's a big difference between R squared and BR. Now, it's a smaller subgroup because most of the patients got R-CHOP in the relevant study, but it might have been a different outcome if it had been BR versus R squared. So I don't forget that part. So I do give bendamustine rituximab. I don't give as much obinutuzumab because of the gallium study and some of the infectious complications that arose. And I don't usually do maintenance after bendamustine for that reason as well. But if they are progressing quickly after a bendamustine frontline and they're not transformed, then I do like lenalidomide and rituximab in that second line setting for those patients. And then just to play the whole discussion, if they had a lenalidomide-based approach frontline, they're relapsing early and I can't put them on trial that they're not transformed, I might use obinutuzumab bendamustine in that setting based off of Gadolin.
Tell me the trial that you're most excited right now in the next 2 years to put a patient on in frontline follicular lymphoma.
I think the most exciting study right now is going to be the epcoritamab plus R squared versus R chemo study, because it really is one of the few studies that's going head to head with R chemo, which is, I think, probably the most competitive comparator to look against, because if you beat that, then that's noteworthy. Now, again, you can be a little critical about the fact it's R squared plus epcoritamab, which is the CD20, CD3 bispecific. How much competition for that CD20 epitope are you going to have with rituximab and epcoritamab? Nonetheless, they've already combined R squared with epcoritamab, so we already know what the safety and the efficacy in the second line or later settings looks really good. So I think that's a study that I'm particularly excited to see it play out. Now, not in my toolkit, but there's a really interesting study being done in the Northeast looking at mosunetuzumab that's a response lenalidomide augmented study. So what that means is they start with mosunetuzumab monotherapy. After a couple cycles, you get a scan. If you're in a PET CR, perfect. You just stay on your mosunetuzumab and finish out 8 cycles and stop. If you're not, then they add the lenalidomide in. So essentially, it's just adding the toxicity for the patients that need it. Now, we don't know if lenalidomide is going to overcome the, you know, potential lack of CR, but I think that's an interesting approach for patients that don't need the additional toxicity of lenalidomide. And we know that about 60% of patients in the relapse setting get a CR from mosun that appears to be quite durable. So that to me is really intriguing. It raises a lot of questions about how do we do response adaptive therapy in follicular, which we've not really done to date.
Yeah, we're dipping our toe into the Hodgkin's confusion then with risk adapted therapy, but certainly, you know, you can only start to do that when you're starting to see outcomes or in a disease space where you're really considering, you know, how much therapy we should be doing. And absolutely for the vast majority of our follicular lymphoma patients, we have that opportunity to kind of really be strategic in our therapies and frontline into the, you know, 11th, 12th line with follicular lymphoma. Well, with that, I want to thank you, Loretta, for joining us today on Blood Club. This has been just a very educational, last 15 to 17 minutes here about follicular lymphoma and where you see in your vision the space going. Thank you again for coming today.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Always a pleasure.